We are talking today with Mark Linus. He is author of High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis. Mark, thanks for coming in today.
Thanks for having me here.
Let's begin with, can you tell us what the motivation was for writing High Tide?
Well, you know what? I used to be a proper environmental activist. I used to do the Julia Butterfly stuff and sit up trees and build tunnels to try and stop damaging road projects back in the UK, where I'm from. And I'd done this for a couple of years, really, as part of the Earth First movement and so on, and it just began to dawn on me that there was this much bigger scale thing going on. And so we could stop, well, we couldn't actually, we tried to stop individual roads or even airport runways from being built and destroying sort of large swathes of what was left of the British countryside. And yet at the same time, I knew that gradually there was this threat called global warming, which was looming over everything, which would be a million road projects over the countryside in terms of the actual damaging effect it would have. And so it was almost a shift from the local to the global that was happening within the movement. And it was really, that I think that was what raised my awareness that there was this big looming crisis happening. And so I began to find out more about it. And then coincidentally, back in 2000, we had these incredible floods in Britain. And so I just remembered there was this sort of torrential rain. Something I'd never really experienced before. And when I started to look into the background to this and spoke to some of the scientists, they were telling me that there was this trend towards heavy rainfall and it was pretty clearly linked with global warming. So it was almost as if climate change came to me first. And then after that, I started to go off and see different places around the world where it's already happening.
So how did you end up choosing the places that you ended up going to?
Well, it was a process of research and also places that caught my interest most, but I really wanted to show how this was a worldwide issue by visiting different continents and choosing a different kind of case study for each different continent that I visited. But the sort of the central theme is really a trip back in my own past by retracing the steps that my father took when we were living in Peru, and he was part of this geological expedition up into the highest part of the Andes. And so I went up there, of course, armed with a picture of how the glacier, some of the glaciers look when he was studying them in 1980. And so there is a sort of a central theme of this book is almost me, let's say, retracing my father's steps. And the before and after pictures are in the beginning of the book, which show really, really incredibly striking images of how the glaciers have disappeared within the space of just 20 years. And, you know, I was stunned when I saw this. I hadn't expected it at all.
Was that true of all the places you visited, that you kind of went in with a certain expectation level and found out it was worse?
Yeah, if anything, because often when, you know, I've also worked as a journalist, and often when you look into a story, you find there's not much actually supporting it. You know, the stories can have a sort of habit of evaporating the deeper you prod around. But it was almost the opposite when I was doing this, that the impacts of climate change that I could find out about from research on the internet or phoning up people and so on were nothing compared to actually what I saw with my own eyes. You know, when I was in north of China, in Inner Mongolia, I'd heard that there were these dust storms and so on, but being in one and actually experiencing how the land's turning so rapidly to desert because they've got these terrible droughts, which are again linked with climate changes, you know, the whole world just turned dark. There was just dust everywhere, you can't breathe. You know, it was really quite an experience. And so that kind of thing adds a bit of drama to the book as well, because, of course, I was writing a travelogue. There's been so many academic, you know, dull books about climatology and so on, and I wanted to do something which would hopefully reach out to a more wider audience, especially at this time. You know, I began to have some sense that people are getting more interested in global warming, and it's certainly the case now that it's really beginning to, there is sort of a wave, I think, of hopefully, which is beginning to raise people's awareness in a way which hasn't been the case before. I mean, there has been this kind of conspiracy of silence about climate change, which has been promoted by the highest levels of the government in this country, and also the corporations. So perhaps people are beginning to break through this sort of corporate wall of silence.
So let's talk about some of the different areas that you did view firsthand. And the first place you said was in your home in the UK.
That's right. And so I went to visited different parts of the country which are affected by flooding, and my first destination was York, and all the railways were cut off. I mean, this was the worst incidence of flooding that had happened since records began in the UK, which I think was back in 1766. So there'd been, you know, 300 years of records, and there'd been nothing like this in the past before. And I went down also to the Welsh borders.
What time of year was this at?
This happens in winter. Okay. So it's a strange trend because you get more dry weather in the summer, and so it's getting hotter in the summer. It's also warmer in the winter, but you get much heavy rainfall in the winter. So it's the weather patterns are changing in all of the different seasons. And the one of the guys I met in this little village on the Welsh borders, who owned a restaurant, and there was mud halfway up his walls. He'd just been flooded out for the third time that year, and he said, "You know, look, we don't get a winter anymore. We don't get snow, we don't get ice. What we get is a wet season. It's almost like we've moved to the tropics." And that phrase, Britain's wet season, became the chapter title, because it really stuck with me as sort of summing up what the changes that people are seeing, which are this dramatic.
It actually kind of struck me because it seemed a lot of what you were describing that was happening there seems to be what we're starting to get here in the Pacific Northwest. We're getting our winters are getting much tamer, but we're getting these rains that come fewer and farther between. But when they do come, it's just this torrential downpour for 12, 24 hours, where you get 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month's worth of water. Mm. And that sounds like what was happening in the book.
Yeah, and obviously what I've been telling you so far is anecdotal stuff, but this is where, also in the book there is a foundation of science, and if you look into the scientific records of what's happening with the precipitation, as you get a warmer atmosphere, it can hold more water vapor, and therefore for the same precipitation event, there's simply more water able to fall out of the sky, and you get, therefore, heavier rainfall. And so it's a very clear relationship with having a warmer atmosphere of getting these kinds of, as you say, more torrential rain. And the records show that it's happening right across the Northern Hemisphere. So it's a global phenomenon. It's happening in America. It's happening in Russia. It's happening in the mid-latitudes, also in the Southern Hemisphere, in places like South Africa and even Australia. So, yes, something's happening. And the counterbalance of that, of course, is worse drought. And so in places like China, where I visited, all of the rain which is now falling in places like here and in the UK isn't falling in places like China. And so they've had droughts there which were the worst for centuries. And there's places I went where you can sort of walk across lake beds and there's old boats just sitting there, and people told stories about how they used to be fisher people, and they, of course, there's no fish for miles around because there isn't a drop of water in the whole of the place. So that's that kind of thing. And of course, what really strikes you is that the people, I was the first person they'd ever told their stories to. And so this is happening quietly, There isn't a great fanfare, and CNN isn't there when their first islanders leave their islands and have to move to higher land because of rising sea levels. It's so we don't really get to hear about it, even though global warming itself is catching people's interest. It affects the poor, and it affects people who are vulnerable in ways which we have very little experience of, and which we can't really help them.
That's another feature of your book that I really enjoy, is the fact that you talk to both scientists, but the real bulk of it is talking to regular people and kind of getting their stories, and people that have... it sounds like you actually seek out the older people because they're the ones with, the memory.
Older people are best because, of course, they've got a whole lifetime of experience and they can say the weather's changed, because these things have happened quite recently. I mean, in geological time, it's just a blink of an eye that this stuff's all happening in. But in terms of our human experience, it's trends over 30 or 40 years, which are the ones that you've got to look out for. And, of course, old people can say, well, when I was a kid, the water didn't come up here. And that kind of thing is really valuable.
Was Alaska the next place you visited after the UK?
Yeah, Alaska I went to in 2001. And, this is a story that probably is more familiar to people in this part of the world, certainly in the Pacific Northwest. There's been stuff in the New York Times about this since then as well. And because Alaska not being contiguous with the lower 48, but also being part of America, the stories get out much more widely. And it really is quite striking what you see in terms of how the melting of the permafrost is affecting buildings and roads. You're almost like being seasick when you're driving along the roads, because you're going up and down these undulations, because as the permafrost melts, the ice thaws in the ground and the water runs away, and so the ground actually collapses. And so you can see direct evidence of this. There's places where buildings are tilting over at crazy angles. And it's also affecting wildlife in that part of the world. There's forests which are basically turning into bogland as the permafrost melts, and the animal behaviors are changing quite dramatically. Bears don't know whether to hibernate. Species like ducks, which fly south for the winter, are still there in December. And I spoke to particularly the native people, have a lot of interesting experiences here because they live so close to the land. And there was one village on the coast I went to, and people were saying that they'd chased all over the sea for thousands of miles and caught only one walrus, you know, because the migration patterns of these animals had changed. They disappeared in up north to try and keep the colder, with the colder ice, much earlier in the year, because the ice retreats that much earlier. So there's all sorts of ways in which global warming is happening, and it's happening much faster in places like Alaska, which are at the poles, obviously, than it's happening in lower down in latitudinally. So you see an acceleration of global warming, and that's really, it's happening that much more quickly there. There's something like 6 degrees of warming they've experienced in the winter in the last 30 years, which is off the map, really.
When I first started reading about global warming 10 or so years ago, they predicted a lot of this, but you didn't even get the impression back then that it would be kicking in as badly as it is now. You know, you expected that like 50 years from when they're writing that. Is that what you have heard from scientists as well, that this is like way ahead of schedule?
Yeah, I really feel this, and I feel that this year as well. It's almost, you know, when you get very familiar with the subject, you don't actually stay scared, but I stay scared on this because I keep hearing new things. I mean, we had this incredible heat wave in 2003, just last year, in Europe, and you probably heard about it. I'm sure it must have made the news partly, that 20 or 30,000 people died simply because of these incredibly cripplingly high temperatures. And at the time, people weren't sure whether to ascribe it to global warming. You know, you want to be scientific. No one wants to suggest that a single event is to do with climate change and so on. But then when the scientists did look at it and they figured out the statistical possibility of this kind of heat wave happening, it was like a 1 in 100,000 year event. I mean, it was completely off the scale. It was actually statistically impossible. And this kind of heat wave comes into the computer models of what the predictions are, but it comes in 2050, 2060, 2070. And we had it in 2003, you see? And I think it's that kind of thing that really gives us a shock that perhaps global warming is beginning to accelerate, and perhaps the Earth is going to respond much more quickly, because we tend to think of it as a very slow, long-term process. Perhaps it's not. Perhaps things are changing much more rapidly, and perhaps we will lose control of it. I certainly hope not, because if global warming accelerates out of control, then we are in the kind of trouble which we'll see the likely collapse of human civilization. And this is what writing this book is sort of aimed at, raising awareness so that we can still start to mitigate climate change while we still have time.
So after Alaska, where did you go next?
After Alaska, I went to Tuvalu, which will be soon, because these are the islands. This is an island nation in the South Pacific, which is affected by rising sea levels. And it was soon after arriving there, actually, and the land is only about half a meter above sea level, because these are coral atolls and they're very low-lying. And soon after arriving there, we were splashing around in water, which was being forced up through the rock by the high tide. And there was first it's puddles, and then there's a lake, and then pretty much half of the town is underwater. You know, and people will say that this is something which didn't used to happen 30 years ago. So, again, you've got very visual evidence of how global warming is affecting rising sea levels and how it's affecting people directly there. And they are planning for the end in this place. I mean, they're 75 people a year are now leaving the islands to live in New Zealand. So they're more or less starting the evacuation of their entire country. And people are asking questions about why their country has to go under when they've done so little to cause the problem. It's a tiny country. They use hardly any fossil fuels, so they're hardly causing any aspect of the global warming crisis. And yet they're the first ones to suffer. And so they're also thinking perhaps of trying to sue the United States, or maybe sue ExxonMobil, or to try and get some kind of financial recompense for this. But it doesn't really look like the international legal system will allow that kind of liability. But the moral liability is crystal clear.
Now, they're obviously experiencing this firsthand, and my understanding is that they had done numerous trips in the past when they discovered that the water level was rising. They had gone to the, you know, the Western nations and said, look at what we're experiencing here. What happened when they did that?
Well, yes, the Tuvaluans have been very forward in actually trying to draw attention to their plight. They were always there at the UN International Climate Change Conferences. There actually was a group of the, it was called the AOSIS, rather like Oasis, rather like sort of Atlantis, sort of evoking that kind of image. But the AOSIS groups of the small island states were there as a block, and they were arguing most strongly, of course, for reductions in greenhouse gas emissions. And, of course, they always got overruled, and or if they did get some promises, they were empty promises, nothing would ever happen. So I think the Tuvaluans got pretty cheesed off and went back to feed their pigs and gather coconuts and all the things they were doing. And they've carried on trying to get these kinds of messages into the international media, but they've realized that as small countries, they have very little weight on the political stage. And it's not until countries like the US and like Europe as well throw their weight behind climate change mitigation that we're actually going to get somewhere.
Yeah, I know it's a very proud moment for the U.S. when we haven't signed the Kyoto Accords. But my understanding is, even if we did do that, that's not nearly enough based on what is currently happening to stop that.
You're talking about Kyoto directly?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Kyoto talks about 5% reductions, and that's only amongst industrialized countries. So, and actually, there's all sorts of loopholes, which means they wouldn't even achieve the 5%. So, in actual fact, it's pretty much a drop in the ocean. But the way that the people defend Kyoto, and I'm one of them, is that it's a first step, and you have to learn to walk before you can run. And so perhaps that is then the basis on which you can build a more lasting international climate treaty, which would go the distance that you need to go to actually solve global warming. But that's a long way off. And, you know, while we've got countries like Australia and like the US and possibly even Canada and Japan still being obstructionist about dealing with climate change and being in sort of in denial about it, we're not going to get anywhere. And so, again, it comes down to people, to real people, to trying to make global warming an electoral issue and trying to get it on the political agenda.
Were there any plans for the island nations to try and, I don't know, pile on rock and dirt on top of there to build the islands up to withstand this?
Well, that's not really possible because there isn't any there aren't materials out there. I mean, if they actually build roads on Tuvalu with some of the development money, and all the aggregates for that come from Fiji in a big tanker, you simply can't, on a coral atoll, there simply isn't any material to enable you to raise your land level, and you couldn't really do that and live a normal life either, because one of the problems which is happening there is that people grow their vegetables, this sort of root crop with like taro called pulaka, in pits which grows off the groundwater there, and as you get sea levels rising, you get salt water coming into these pits and it kills off the plants. And so the whole basis of the sort of subsistence economy that they have, and coconut trees and all this kind of thing, it depends on nature. You can't live completely in an artificial, on an artificial island. It just isn't sustainable for people to do that, and nor is it economically feasible. So they have to move. That's the only option.
When you had the idea for producing this book, did you know that you would be going to all these different places ahead of time? Did you have to, like, pitch the book and your publisher would pay you for some of these trips?
Well, that was always the idea, but you know what it's like. When you get an idea and you figure it out, you know that you're going to go and do it anyway. So I went to Alaska before I'd got a publishing deal even, and I sort of knew in my heart of hearts I was going to go there and do this journey come what may. But then I did get a contract with HarperCollins. It's published by Picador in the US, but it was HarperCollins originally in the UK that bought it. And they gave me an advance, you know, an author's advance, which paid for quite a lot of the trip. So whilst I ended last year in debt, I wasn't nearly as deeply in debt as I would have been otherwise. And also you have the knowledge and you have the guarantee of actually getting the book out there, which is a real privilege, I think, to know that you're going to have a publisher behind you who's going to be doing the promotional work, who's going to be making the book look good, and is going to be getting it out there into the shops. Because, you know, there's so many people who write really great books which are published by niche publishers, and they just don't go anywhere because people don't find out about them, and that's a big shame. So I went with HarperCollins, which is part of the News International. It's the Murdoch empire, so, you know, we're dancing with the devil here. But the point of going with a corporate publisher was to get access to that kind of distribution with what is quite a radical message.
So you're at Tuvalu. Is that at that period in time, did you know you were about halfway through the places you were going to visit?
I had a sort of itinerary, but it evolved because, I mean, as I say, I did these trips over a period of about 3 years. I went back to my home base in Oxford to do more research and to sort of rest, because if you're doing a global journey like that, and if you go from one place to another, then you just find that it's incredibly difficult to sustain yourself, because you've got to find out where you're going next. There's a lot of work you've got to do, and you just get exhausted. I mean, think of all the the jet lag as much as everything else. So it took a long time to do this, because when I was in the location, I had to really put everything into it and spend a lot of time with people and really begin to try and see things through their eyes, so that I could really feel the way that the people feel the impacts that they're seeing in front of them.
Yeah, I guess that's where I was going, was thinking about the emotional strain of like going to these different places and continually getting this bad news.
Yeah. You know? Well, and it's an issue that comes up when I'm promoting the book. When I'm doing talks, for example, I sometimes do a little health warning and say, you know, this, what you're about to see is probably the most depressing thing that you ever, you know, there should be some kind of label you could put. But the problem is that it is depressing, and there isn't very many ways you can sweeten the pill, because what we are talking about is a level of loss, not just in human terms, but in terms of the natural world as well, which is very difficult to comprehend. And there's people I work with who also do climate change stuff in Britain, and you kind of find that everybody's had this experience when all of a sudden there's something that triggers them in their minds, and there's something which suddenly makes it go from an intellectual issue in their heads to an emotional issue in their hearts. And one of the people who I quote in the book, who actually came up with the solution to global warming, which we can talk about in a second if you like, a guy called Aubrey Mayer, he said that when he first figured it out, he was basically crying in the corridor for a week. You know, and he's a strong, articulate, you know, guy, very experienced, pretty, you know, incredible intelligence, and yet it just hit him in some way. He was thinking about his daughter's future, in fact, and it was that, not his own future, that really. And I had the same sort of experience when I was at the UN climate conference in The Hague. Ironically enough, I was at the American delegation briefing. And they were just coming out with all of this sort of waffle about how America was extremely committed to stopping climate change and so on, whilst behind the closed doors they were busy shooting everything down that they possibly could. And it was somehow, I had that realization that these people were not going to do the job for us. They were going to take us over the edge and further. They were going to destroy the planet, basically. And I wanted to sort of stand up and shout and go, "You sons of bitches, how can you do this?" And That was what hit me, and I left that room almost in tears. And I, you know, it was, and I think that moment is, it's that kind of moment that you have, which keeps driving you on and keeps driving you on. And so I've had that in me. It's almost a religious thing, actually. And I shouldn't say that, because this is a scientific issue, but your commitment comes from that sort of level of willpower and that level of emotional commitment, I think. So that's the intensity of it when you're working with this. And it is very difficult to sometimes to get out of bed in the morning. It is also very difficult to stay positive, because the enormity of the problem and the lack of response that you get from everybody that you talk to about it. You know, "Oh, I've got to drive my car." "Oh, well, that's that then." "The planet had better die," you know. It is very difficult to keep thinking that there's a way through this, but what other choice have we got? There's got to be a way through it, and if there is a way through it, we've got to find it.
So what solutions have you encountered in this trip?
Well, there's different levels of this. I mean, there's personal changes we can all make in our own lifestyles, which are things as obvious as driving your car less or giving up your car. I mean, I haven't had a car for years now, but it's easier to do that when you're not living somewhere like, well, Seattle, or even worse, like LA, where you've got incredible sprawl and there's just simply no way to shift quickly to public transportation or even bicycling. But there's that kind of thing. You know, you can switch to green electricity in the UK as well, where you simply just fill in a form and you get renewable power. Which is pretty good. You can change your own light bulbs to more energy efficient. I mean, simply it's a case of reducing your own fossil fuel consumption and therefore your own emissions. But actually, I think that's only the basis of action. We've really got to tackle this at the political level now. It's got to become an issue which people feel they're part of a movement, and they feel they're part of a growing movement which is actually going to go somewhere. And the political solution, which I think is most sane, really, is this one called contraction and convergence, where essentially what happens is that all of the world's countries get together and they agree on a budget for greenhouse gas emissions. And they say, okay, we're going to stay within this limit of global warming, therefore we can only burn this much coal, oil and gas. And once you've got this limit and this budget set at a sustainable level, the question is how you distribute it. And of course, the only way you can make this happen politically is to have fair shares for everybody. So you then have a per capita distribution amongst all the world's nations, which means that China and India get a lot, the UK and Japan get much less. And they should be tradable in between them, so you have a sort of convergence process. But essentially, when you're talking about rationing, this is what got us in Britain through the Second World War, was knowing that we all had equal access to what was left of our food supplies. And we had a national emergency. This is a global emergency, and we've all got to make the same kinds of sacrifices. And I think the Contraction and Convergence Program, which is actually it's on the web, gci.org.uk, it's promoted by the Global Commons Institute, is being taken seriously now in at the governmental levels in Europe. The African countries have signed up to it pretty much. So has India and China increasingly as well. And even in fact, some of the guys who are on the American delegation who talk all the time about they can't sign Kyoto because it doesn't include developing countries, you say, okay, well, great. Here's a program which would include developing countries because it includes the whole world, but you've got to agree to equity. You know, and they might say, hey, it's communism, but, you know, it's not communism if you're talking about fairness, which includes all of the world's people, because how can you defend overconsumption in one country and underconsumption in another in perpetuity? You can't. So the only other option is to have economic growth everywhere, and we see the world collapse. So that's why fairness is not just politically correct, it's actually the only way through.
And how do we break through the corporate media's hold on the viewpoints on this? I mean, so much of this, we could be 10 years ahead of where we are now if we'd only heard about this, you know, 10, 12 years ago when people were first talking about it.
Well, I think we have to make it impossible for them not to talk about it on the corporate media. I actually did a spot on Fox News, the O'Reilly Factor, about 2 weeks ago. And I tell you, that was an experience because, I knew all about Bill O'Reilly and what his take was likely to be, because I think there was one time when he didn't even shout down some September the 11th victims' families and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I knew where he was coming from, and I was sort of all geared up for this row. It turned out, actually, he wasn't hosting. There was a different guy called John Kashinick or something hosting it. He was a Republican ex-senator, but... And actually, he was asking reasonable questions. So, and I said that I'd come back from Tuvalu with this message, this appeal to the American people, which is what people had said to me when they were in Tuvalu, that climate change was destroying their country and people had to hear this message. But then he ended up with this bizarre assertion that he was a Christian, that the other guest, who was a woman from a right-wing foundation called the Heritage Foundation, was a Christian, and that I shouldn't be making the environment God. And that was a sign-off. And so you end up in some strange situations when you try to get this kind of message out in the in sort of more conventional media. But you have no choice, because this is what people are watching. Whilst it's good to try and cover all your bases and talk to people where you're preaching to the choir as well, because they're the people who are going to be the basis of political action, at the same time, you do need to try and break out into the mainstream, you know. And my book's published by the corporate media, as I say, so I'm 100% behind trying to do that kind of thing, so long as you can keep your integrity and you're not actually selling out in the process.
Seems like in this country, in a lot of ways, people live in such denial that more often than not, we need disasters to get us motivated.
Well, disaster movies, yeah.
Well, no, we use disaster movies for entertainment purposes.
Right.
Real disasters we ignore by going to the movies. So, and it looks like in a lot of ways we've created that disaster that, you know, one way or another, we're going to force ourselves to have to deal with this. Do you think it's actually not too late at this point to get a grip on this?
No, it's not too late now, but the window of opportunity is closing rapidly. I mean, we've probably only got, 10 years really to make greenhouse gas emissions peak and then start to go down. And if you look at any of the economic forecasts, they're talking about emissions rising for the next century or more. And so that's the challenge that we've got, really, which is why if Bush gets back into the White House, we're running out of time. So that's why this election is really crucial for the future of the whole of the planet, actually. This is one of the things that I talk about. Time is running out, but it's important to remember that it's not too late and that we can avoid the disasters, because when they come, it will be too late. By the time global warming has got the momentum to really affect people in a way which cripples economies and which puts millions of people off the land and hungry, then we're reducing greenhouse gas emissions probably won't make much difference. Mm. And so we've got to avoid that scenario.
In addition to your book, what other resources can people turn to get more information, get more support on this?
Well, I do think of this as a campaigning tool, in fact. I mean, I've started off as a campaigner. I'm more of a campaigner than I'm a writer, actually, between you and me and our listeners here and the viewers. And so in the back of the book, I have a list of websites and so on. It's fairly well known. I mean, there's Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth who are running campaigns on this, NRDC. There's that kind of thing. But also, I think it's important that people don't just leave it to the environmental groups now. We've really got to be talking to our senators about this. We've got to be talking to local politicians about this. We've got to talk to friends and family about this and make people face up to their own lifestyle choices. And so climate change has got to get personal. You know, it's not the role of some professional campaigners to keep moving this one forward, because it's got to be out there and it's got to be the concerns of, it is already the concerns of millions of people. They just don't realize it yet.
Well, with that, we're unfortunately out of time. Just been talking with Mark Linus. He is author of the new book, High Tide, The Truth About Our Climate Crisis.